the work itself becomes obsolete. The concept of allegory, in spite of Benjamin's historical focus, prepares the ground for three types of interpretation of modernism. First and perhaps best known is Lukács' claim, curiously analogous to one of the points of Adorno's early critique of Benjamin, that the allegories of the avant-garde fetishize the fragmented ruins of civil society and eliminate the possibility of the de-fetishizing totalization. In Adorno's mediation, which points beyond our world, footnote 101. Text. Second is Habermas's argument, derived from Adorno's later essayistic practice, that modernism incorporates the cracks and crevices of a world torn apart mercilessly into its representations. Through creating an artificial distance, it lays bare the world constructed as crises. Footnote 102, text. Finally, there is the argument derived through the prism of Ernst Bloch's appropriation of Benjamin, footnote 103, text, certainly justified by Benjamin's anti-authoritarian stylistic predilections, that the presentation of a world as ruin or as fragments defines modern art as experimental and, in particular, open to the active participation and intervention of the receivers. Benjamin's own conscious utilization of his earlier theory of allegory in his Marxist period, which presents a rather strong contrast to his two essays reproduced below, must be considered in light of these heterogeneous interpretations of the meaning of his work. Page 213. To Benjamin, the collective, intersubjective moments of historical experience do not disappear without traces, even in the period of civil society that is characterized by the disintegration of traditional supporting substantial experience. Paradoxically, it is the experience of shock so characteristic of industrial civilization that involuntary, as in Proust's memoir Involontaire, stimulates remembrance. What is remembered? Collective rituals, festivals, and a different qualitative relationship to nature? Footnote 104, text. Who remembers? Benjamin postulates a collective memory repressed by a totally inaccessible, which is recalled by individuals when the correspondence between its symbols and events of our everyday life is attained. When is such a remembrance possible? Benjamin explores in the context the material texture of everyday urban life, and he lets strange and unusual correspondence emerge as unintended consequences of speech, of work, of strolling, the flânerie of the flâneur, of literary or theoretical activity. But in two instances, at least, the correspondences, now called dialectical images, are consciously pursued. The poet Baudelaire, confronted by the disappearance of those experiential materials that historically supported poetry, raises the principle of this disappearance, the transformation of perception by shock to a new poetic principle. He thus managed to fashion out of the disappearance of aura a new mode of art. Footnote 105, text. The result is an allegorical art that reveals once again the natural physiognomy of the present as ruin and juxtaposes to the ruins of the bourgeoisie elements of dream, memory, and fantasy stimulated by shock, but recalling or anticipating a different collective character of experience. It is this juxtaposition that is called the dialectical image, standing still without resolution, dialectic im Stillstand, but inviting the dreamer to awake. Footnote 106, text. The second procedure that consciously pursues the dialectical image of the present is Benjamin's own. We believe that this was his own principle of form to collect and reproduce in quotation the contradiction of the present without resolution. This formal principle is the outer limits of a non-authoritarian essayistic attitude to a potential audience, one that was never reached even by Adorno, who thought a more active dialectic. It is very controversial whether the inner logic of Benjamin's aesthetic theory stops with the anti-authoritarian theory of the dialectic at a standstill. The fact that the second major alternative within his aesthetic theory implies the discovery of the identical principle in Brecht's epic theater. Footnote 107, text, where the audience is ultimately never completely spared explicit political solutions and resolutions, has aroused the understandable skepticism of his friend Adorno and Scholem, recently echoed by Habermas. Page 214. And yet, the steps to Brecht follow from a crucial difference between Benjamin's and Adorno's aesthetics. Benjamin's stress in analyzing a work is displaced vis-à-vis Adorno in the direction of the condition of production and reception. The formal characteristics of the work itself were less important to Benjamin. It was of greater importance to him to insist on the liberating possibilities of the work of the past and the future in relationship to collective modes of production and reception. He was ready to surrender the aura of the creative personality even where, as in the case of Baudelaire, Kafka, Proust, and himself, the works produced were open and critical. In this context, he welcomed those technologies that made all individual genius obsolete, and even more the one author, Bertolt Brecht, who attempted to raise this moment of the decline of aura along with other elements to the formal principle of a collective political art. The 1937 essay, The Author as Producer, reproduced below is the best summary of Benjamin's defense of Brecht, but it is also remarkable for its apology for the instrumentalization of art in the Soviet Union. To be sure, Benjamin attacks artistic autonomy not in the name of administration, but in the name of a collective, open, experimental, technically innovative political art form. Brecht's theater is a dramatic laboratory which uses all of its technical sophistication to make the self-education of audiences possible. The play, an experimental setup, fosters two dialogues, one between the producers of the play with the advanced technical means of communication, and another between actor, author, technical personnel, and the reduced men of today. The two dialogues allow the audience to become co-author, co-actor of the production. Benjamin imagined that the Soviet films of the 1920s and the Soviet newspapers were already prototypes of the new active relationship between work and audience. In the 1930s, this illusion could only legitimate the increasingly repressive culture politics of the Soviet state, and Benjamin naively for a moment affirmed the right of this state to its interference with artistic autonomy. Footnote 108, text. This confusion of free collectivity with authority already revealed the uneasy tension of those two elements of Brecht's place, which Benjamin thought to immediately unify, revolutionary technique in the politics of the existing revolution. The confusion is present in the terminology. Brecht's and Benjamin's references to the masses as the matrix of current aesthetic discussion smacks of the same revolutionary instrumentalization that culture is to undergo. The full identification of industrial production as we now know it and artistic production points in the same direction, if we keep Marx's description of capitalist production in mind.